Well, it's April 18th. It's really early in the morning, as you can tell from the timestamp. Was sitting here thinking, and I really haven't thought much when it comes to Mesa Lands and the choices and decisions I made in relation to my experience there. Like I said, it's only been 8 weeks, which surprises me. I'm at a new job. I'm certainly making comparable money to what what I would have been making. I really don't know what's happened since then. The apparatus was set up that you will only hear and see what the leadership at Mesa Lands wants you to see. So, as a member of the public, I'm as blind as anybody else is. And honestly, beyond just curiosity to see what's going to happen, I've often said that it's not interesting to be kind of a gawker, which I think is what anybody is who doesn't intend on, doing something. People who scream for answers and want transparency and things like that, without much of an intention of doing anything about the information that they get. That's just like somebody who's, when you're traveling down like the interstate and there's been an accident, but it was on the side of the road. People had pulled it to the side of the road, or it had actually happened on the side of the road. People who jam up traffic, not because of the wreck directly, but because they insist on slowing down, rubbernecking, stuff like that. I've always been quite, I didn't think much of the people that were doing that. And I don't know if I schooled myself this way or if I just am this way, that making sure that people aren't inconvenienced unduly by things was always the most important thing to me. And I'm like I've said all along this whole thing, I am not here trying to justify my actions. I'm not here trying to take some moral high ground. It's just not, I'm not doing it. Because I just don't look at it, I guess, with those kind of terms. if a sacrifice is needing to be made, I'm willing to take to make a sacrifice. And I know, you know, people are going to behave about any situation the way they're going to behave. I'm not going to jump on people for being themselves. Now, it's kind of depressing if in being themselves, they're very, you know, self-serving, willing to watch other people suffer so that they can, so that they don't have to. And upon reflection, I just woke up and I don't know why I was reflecting on it a little bit. And I've done it a few times in these past 8 weeks. And beyond the emails that I wrote, the communications I made that were somewhat public, the big public one. Do I regret doing that one? No. Do I regret its broad span? You know, honestly, at the end of the day, not really. I don't. I think it's a bit presumptuous. Leadership is really an interesting animal. And I think people want leadership to be kind of cagey. For all the talk about transparency, I don't think anybody really wants it. From the leaders down to the people being led, I don't think anybody wants a lot of transparency. I think there are certain people who are low level and want to be kept in the dark a little so that at some point in the future they can say, hey, it's not my fault. I was kept in the dark. And they kind of want that sort of an excuse. Oh, I don't know if it's an excuse. Anyway, they don't mind being in that circumstance. And that's, you know, that's a personal choice. I think it's a little low. But, you know, that's people. People do what people do. It was very obvious to me that although I was brought in to be a leader, the whole point of the, I think when it came, when Greg Bush was the president, I think, although the stated purpose, and I think I think the conscious purpose was to get leadership from the chief information officer. I think what it ended up being was the desire for a good foot soldier. And don't... It's tricky. It says, don't give leadership to me. And then kind of flush it don't think, and like I said, I'm not, everybody I think behaved exactly how one would expect them to behave. Given the actions that I did, there was a lot of people felt betrayed. And it may be because I'm really, really, I'm not a socialist. And I think, and to be honest, I'm now glad to be back out of academia and the leadership of academia, which is extremely socialistic. You are to subvert yourself to whatever the needs of the academy are. And I'm just not really that sort, and I had been always been somewhat shielded from that. And so in that case, as the chief information officer of a university, I think, or a college, I think I, and I think I said early on, I said, I don't know that I'm really a good choice. I think I'm a poor choice. And I think that Mesa Lance was kind of in a corner, just trying to get whoever they could get and trying to make what they could get in me work. And I, you know. I don't know. I've never thought of myself as a strong personality or really having, not, I never seen myself as not being pliant. But I found out that I wasn't particularly, I was trying to do the job that needed to be done, and sometimes that was something that came from college, from the college president, and a lot of times it wasn't. It was what I thought was the most prudent thing to do, given the shifting sands of the realities there. I don't regret the recommendation I made, and I have found over time that I don't regret the way I gave it. As a basically responsible person, and I guess I viewed it more as an outsider, which I tend to be on almost anything I do. And well, anyway, so given everything that happened, and I come back and I still say to myself, you know what? This is not, I don't I'm glad I did what I did. And I feel like when it comes to being prudent, to being a prudent manager of what one has handed to them, that I did what I felt needed to be done for prudence sake, which probably at the end of the day is what is I guess what drove it. And I can't say that I had some marvelous plan, that I had some amazing thing. I applied the principles of decision making that I have developed over time, which is mostly to pray very hard and listen to what comes back and act on what I hear from God, for lack of anything else. And that's what drove what happened. You know, people can talk about the first public email, you know, and do people feel betrayed? I would imagine so. I think I really have become. I'm sorry. I mean, people are going, you're not completing your sentences. And I go, well, get used to it. This is me, you know. I'm not the god of planning. I'm not saying I can't do some planning, but trust me, when it comes at the end of the day, it rarely goes the way I had planned it, because I tend to follow a different thing, you know. And you can say, well, you're following the wrong spirit, and you go, well, you know what? I'm not going to sit here and quibble with you. I'm going to do what I do. And I get the impression that there's still, well, you know, I don't know. The only interface I have with people at Mesa Lands anymore is through church. And I don't know. Andy's, I don't think Andy's, I wouldn't be surprised if he chose to let me go in a counsel way. And that's fine. It's like, oh no, I understand. I said, I am a bizarre lone wolf sort of person. And, as I have gotten more willing to be vocal, I get a larger sense that people would rather me be vocal someplace else or not vocal at all. Anyway, so yeah. And frankly, what I read in scripture and what I see and therefore talk about, especially in these recordings, is very I don't know exactly what it is, but it's like, this is what I'm seeing in the scriptures, and it's not what people want to hear. It's not what people, you know, want to think about. And yet I said, it's right here. It's not like I don't want to take scriptures out of context. I try not to, and I'm not going to say that I'm God's gift to it, but, you know, these are difficult things to deal with. And do I think that a whole lot of gospel teaching in the church is very whitewashed? Yes, I do. All toward making Christ into portraying the teddy bear Christ. And just as I keep seeing what's going on, does our Heavenly Father love us? Absolutely. When people say Christ did what Christ did out of love for us, it's like, well, maybe. But his stated his stated purposes in, you know, taking upon himself all the sins of people. It was phrased in a strange way. It wasn't phrased individually. It was phrased very collectively. And it was phrased, you know, take upon himself the sins of the world. And you're going, why didn't he say take upon himself the sins of the people or something, or you and I? And you can sit there and try to ferret that out. It's tricky. But it seems, but more and more, Christ, you know, Christ always said that he was doing the will of his Father. In the Garden of Gethsemane, when he said, Father, is there any way that, you know, I don't have to take this bitter cup, I don't have to do this bitter thing? He still did it. But, it really harkens back to what the Father had endowed the Son with. And the Son reconciling himself to what he had been given. You know, this people talk about, wow, Christ had this amazing ability to heal and things like that. And you go, yes. That was one of his, if you were to really try to concentrate on what Christ really did, as opposed to just being kind of a regular person, things that you and I would struggle to do, was his ability to heal, his ability to raise from the dead. What the Father endowed him with, which was power over life and death. I don't know if that's an extension of healing, but anyway, so I'm sorry. I didn't know I was going to get into the religious so far, but, you know, and so I end up saying things that I don't know if they're particularly offensive to people. Some people may take them as offense, but are just uncomfortable and fly in the face of what they have, which is such a deeply loving Christ. And I will never speak against the fact that Christ did what he did, and it was a fantastic thing for us all. It's just interesting that when one looks at what has been recorded of what at least was interpreted as his motivations for doing what he did, that I don't think it was so much love on a universal scale. That, you know, when Christ raised Lazarus from the dead, that was interesting. And when you look at it, you can say, well, he did it because he loved Mary and Martha, you know, who depended on Lazarus. And you're going, well, I'm not denying that. It says, but it took him a long time. And you could tell that he wasn't just doing it out of a sense of love. He was doing it also in his slowness to come, and they were angry with him. Why didn't you come sooner? Now he's dead, and he's not just dead. He's dead, as in several days have passed, and if his spirit was hanging around his body waiting for the opportunity to be easily raised from the dead, you way beyond that. I think Christ, and there's speculation that Christ did that. And maybe it's not just speculation. Maybe it's what Christ was saying, was that he just wanted to show that even given the thoughts of the time about how long somebody could appear dead and still be brought back to life, needed to pass too, so that it could be, once the story was published, once it went out, once the rumor mill started going, that, it said, oh, well, it was 4 days, or at least, I don't remember how long it was. It was more than the prescribed time for being able to do these things. People would often look dead yet not be dead, or slip in and out of death seemingly. And but most people said, if you've been like this for 3 days, you're dead. And so you start wrapping people up and you put them away, or you don't go checking on them. I think half the time mourners come to mourn. Some of them come to mourn because they're paid, I suppose, but some come just to see if something wonderful will happen. All of a sudden, the person will go, oh, and they'll get up and it'll be like, oh my gosh. Sometimes I think that's what long-term mourners, especially close family members or people who really depended on that person for their livelihood, are hopeful for. I guess it happened enough that it was a thing to talk about it. Anyway, so and you're going, Guy, is it really loving to let the family members of Lazarus suffer for some days? He was called. He could have come earlier. He could have come more quickly, but he chose not to for other reasons. And you go, and is this love? And you go, I don't think so. And so, one has to rectify themselves to that, and to know that Christ had a bigger thing going on, and it was somewhat bigger than love. In spite of all the high-minded and high-falutin poetic talk about Christ's love, which I don't disparage, or I don't want to disparage. Anyway, so yeah, this is I am a tricky person, and I think people tend to just say they don't want to have anything to do with me. And I'm sure I cause such anguish for people who go, I would rather that Jason Nimro just didn't come to church, that he just didn't do what Jason Nimro does, and use the church organization as the vehicle for what he's doing. And that flies in the face of, oh no, we love everybody. Everybody's wonderful and we're trying to bring people to Christ. And you go, well, which Christ are you trying to bring them to? Anyway. So it's okay. It's good that I'm far away most of the time, and that I'm not in the thick of things, and that I'm not in the central councils, and I won't, It must be a terrible conflict, inner conflict for people like Andy. Nimrod does some things that we really like, but I don't want to have to deal with him. And you go, I understand. I said, if I could resign and keep my temple recommend, if I could do those other things, I would. Just for the sake of people not being able to just for some of the troubles I cause people. And they really want their teddy bear Jesus. They really want these things. And I'm not here to I'm not here to fight with you about it. Yeah, but there it is. Says, am I ever going to have any kind of position in the church? I don't think so. Anybody who gets to know me any at all doesn't consider me for position in the church. I'm just not the right person. And that's fine. It says, when I was younger, I was real resentful of the fact that I had all this capacity and I had all this knowledge. And why wasn't I being better utilized? Why wasn't I getting into higher leadership positions? And I think I've gotten, and you say, well, he's reconciled himself to the fact that's not going to happen because he's so radical. And it's like, well, this is I didn't think I set out to be radical. It just kind of happened. And I'm not gonna fight it because I think there's value there. Anyway, so how does that relate to Lord Guru's talking about in the first place, Mesa Lance? And you're going, yeah. From early on, well, okay, let's talk. I got hired in August. I came on in August. And I pretty much just kind of kept, when it came to information technology, I just kept doing just kept up the infrastructure that Larry Wickerman put into place. And I wouldn't say bad things about Larry, because I didn't find, I guess I have a wider tolerance for people's behavior. Doesn't mean I'm going to behave that way, but it seemed like there was kind of a cleansing going on at the college, and to a certain extent, maybe that was needed. But I think it got a little, I don't know if it's vindictive or just there was a certain attitude that everybody wanted to see. Everything needed to be very even, I guess. And anybody who popped off or really got I don't know, lost their composure was gonna be gotten rid of. And the sad part was is that newer people who were brought in were getting treated like that. So it wasn't just kind of a trying to clean house from the past, which I think it was how it was being portrayed. It was almost like they wanted a certain behavior pattern. Now, I wasn't certainly fitting into that behavior pattern. So it was like, I do have my passionate side. And it was obvious at Basalands that people were getting canned. People were getting walked out with the cardboard box full of their stuff on a pretty regular basis at Basalands, which was a little it was not a good thing. Not a good thing at all. So everybody was probably a little concerned about that, and I can't say that I would react well in that kind of a situation, and which what we were in. A lot of people who had sacrificed a lot worked very hard. I think about Larry Wickham and Jim Morgan, and those were really the two that I saw that were really gotten rid of, where it's like, you guys are cutting off your nose to spite your face, you know? I know a lot of people thought that me and Jim Morgan were competitors, maybe even enemies, and I was trying to establish myself as the chief information officer that didn't report to Jim Morgan. And that was tough because that was always the responsibility of Jim Morgan. You know, he was always the person that supervised that. And given the circumstances that Mesalands was in, which were an institution that was really too small for the realities of today's academia. You know, this is, as far as I was aware of, the writing was on the wall. It was either consolidate into something larger or die. Now, you know, you can say, well, look, we proved Nemro wrong. We're not dead yet. And you're going, okay, this is, I'm not saying that I was right, but I said the organization isn't really being fixed. Because I don't think staying as a little scrappy in independent college, I don't think that's prudent, you know. And that was what I said in my public letter, you know. You know, I don't say I said that directly, but I think it was pretty easy to see. Everybody was scared to death because I had done this. And it's like, why does he sound like he's acting like he's a leader? And you go, because I think I'm a leader. I'm the chief information officer. I think I'm allowed to speak. And boy, it became very obvious that I was not allowed to speak. I was to, you know, the most important thing was to be loyal. And it added ground down to being loyal to a certain course of action, which I'm sorry, you know, I'm kind of a big picture person, and the big picture was keeping a higher ed institution in Tucumcari. Now, people were angry because I was I was not being loyal to the Mesa Lands organization, which I'm sorry. I said the first time that Larry Wickham and I talked, he talked about the fact that he found that the decisions being made was to make an extremely top-heavy college. And everybody was pretty frank about saying that they had been brought on board under I don't know if you call it false assumptions, whatever. You know, the fiscal state of the college was just a shambles. And my proposition, which was to, people tried to paint it. Everybody tried to paint it really good. I didn't. I didn't try to gild the lilies. I said Mesa Lands needed to end, and a new entity that was a subunit of a college system. And I said, Eastern New Mexico University would probably be the best one to do this on several levels. Because Mesa Lands just needed to die, and there needed to be a new place. It wasn't trying to save Mesa Lands. It was trying trying to be a good steward of the state's investment in higher ed. And it got to the point to where it had become a political thing, Legislators wanted to save Mesa Lands. I don't know why they thought that putting it in the hands of Eastern was going to kill it. I don't get that. And I'm not saying that that wouldn't have been maybe what the end result would have been. I don't think so. I don't think that, given what I knew of the politics, I didn't think that was going to happen. And I don't think it would have, A lot of things happened politically. But it was really interesting to see that it became all the things that people had accused these things of. Just a jobs program, It was all about, look at all these jobs that we have here that have been created because of Mesa Lands. And you're going, well, these jobs are still needed. Even if it gets consolidated into a bigger organization, you still need the people on the ground to keep it running. It just benefits from the strength of something larger. And the people who would suffer the most would be people like me. People who would have been rendered somewhat redundant. And, a university system doesn't need three or four CIOs. It just doesn't, So that person would be something like a site lead or something when it came to information technology. So anyway, top heavy organization, brought in to save it. Now I'm not speaking against Greg Bush either for him having this vision that the college could really grow a lot bigger and could grow its way out of its problems. It just wasn't the fiscal reality, as far as I saw it. I think other people saw it, maybe saw it too. I don't know. except that they said, no, people, a state won't let a college die, and they were correct, you know. But that state will also continue to prop up what I consider to be kind of a cancerous situation. And there was a good opportunity to say this needed to be done. You could sell it to the public rather readily, especially if they said, and the new branch campus of Eastern, which would take over, you know, what Mesaland was, and still needs people. Still needs people to do what a lot of those people to continue to have them doing what they're doing now, you know, is in the new reality of being able to do a lot of classes virtually. You don't need so many people under so many banners doing the same thing, you know. The whole concept of the super teacher. Have this really amazing teacher who comes up with this really amazing, you know, that has a really amazing teaching style, but that could be rendered to video. And you can have a lot of different institutions. You can run several renditions of that person's class and have it be proctored by people, and a lot of people who are right now called professors would fall to the task of being kind of a proctor and being kind of a local teaching assistant to the super teacher. It's kind of like the idea of the remote megachurch. I saw that too over in Oklahoma. The old empty strip mall all of a sudden becomes this huge mega church, and it is kind of a big name preacher who might even be at a distance, you know, and you would beam in their charismatic presentation, and then sub pastors on the ground wherever you are would do the legwork, you know. But see, most people, when they become professors, they want to off shift that legwork. They want to be able to be up there and try their hand at being charismatic. Come on. Doesn't anybody, at least on some level? There's some people who do, some people who don't. Anyway. I think there was a certain amount of, hey, this isn't what I came in here to get. For Mesa Lands, you know, this was my chance to be the central person, even if it's in a little tiny place, you know. And I, you know, and people either say this is good enough for me, or it's just a stepping stone to something else, or whatever. You know, a lot of people use these opportunities, these positions, to do whatever they want, you know. And so, yeah, in putting out my proposal, I was shooting a hole in a lot of things. And, you know, I got a lot of angst back. You're scaring the students. And you're going, I'm sure I'm not scaring the students half as much as I am presenting a scenario that frightens you as a faculty member, or you as a college, as a tiny college administrator, that, you know, this was what you were expecting. And you go, well, none of us are getting what we expected. I thought I was going to be this leader of a IT that was, at least had some funding behind it. And it wasn't. And it's not going to be for a long time, probably. At least that was the way it's being portrayed was, hey, you're going to have to tighten your belt and everything's just going to have to kind of cruise, but everything's going to be fine. And you're going, IT's got a bad habit of not behaving that way. You can play that for a little while, but you're going to have to, you're going to have to replace things. Things don't last forever, and these are expensive pieces of equipment. Anyway, and faced with a lot of those things, and it just ended up being at the end of the day. There was that one day. It was. I think it was Valentine's Day, or no, it was the day before Valentine's Day. It was the 13th. It was February 13th that I pretty much came, and I don't think I had a clear picture, but I was like, well, this is, let's just see what happens. And wow, I got given my marching orders by somebody who had no clue about how to handle information technology. And it's like, oh, okay. You don't want somebody who knows what they're doing. You want somebody to do what you say. And you're going, that's not chief information officer. And you know what? That's not what I was hired for. So there's no point me having this job. And yeah, in my resignation, I pretty much said, please don't hire a chief information officer. That's disingenuous. I basically told him, bring back Larry. Larry did a fantastic job, and he's exactly the kind of person that you probably want here. And if he's not the right kind of person for what you guys want here, then I don't know what you want except a bunch of IT tech slaves. It says, I don't know I don't know the qualifications or the background of the cabinet secretary that was pretty much getting into my face and telling me what I should be doing. And I'm not saying that I'm God's gift to anything, except that it was like, well, okay. I said, you're saying then this is what you're going to do, and this is how it's going to go, and this is it. It's like, well, I'm not going to do that. And so, what did I need to do? It says, I guess I'm sure people would say that you needed to fight. You needed to fight for what you knew was right. And you go, I'm not a fighter, guys. It says, if the consensus is against me, and it most certainly was in that situation, it was, you need to get into line. Everybody was all about their particular thing. And that it needed to hold sway. And it was like, well, I said, no, I'm not going to sit here and I'm not going to watch that happen. And I'm not going to be a party to it. And I'm not going to be a part of it. And I'm not going to be some ineffectual flunky to it and have a lot of, I'm sorry. And I don't want to pound on youth particularly. And I was getting a little into stuff that I had no business getting into. I had no experience in that. Like fundraising and stuff like that. It really wasn't my realm. Everybody said, well, we need to get into it. And you go, no, what you're looking for is for somebody to drop their job and to help you with your job. And you go, yeah, we're a team. And you go, no, that's not teamwork. I said, That's telling other people that their job and their responsibilities are not important, and that your concerns are paramount. Anyway, and I'm not saying anything bad about anybody. Everybody does what they have to do to survive, and everybody. Most people don't have enough time and enough resources to do what it would be great could be done. And so everybody behaved exactly how they would do, including me. I'm not saying I'm, like I said, not saying I'm some paragon. Anyway, so yeah, I left. And when I go back and I look at it and I go, I don't want to say anything bad about anybody. Everybody was trying to do a good job with what they had and doing what they could do. And when it finally came down, it was really a question for at least me to say, you know what, I can save the college $100,000 by just not being here. And the IT department was in good shape. It was in good shape when I got there, and I don't think I really killed it in leaving. I think all the purchases that I made were at least halfway prudent. If nothing else, I just kept up the infrastructure that Larry and Jim had put into place, which I think was a good one. They were certainly working in the right direction. I think Larry had a wonderful take on it. Much I was trying to get up to the understanding that he had. He was doing an excellent job. And that's why when I resigned and I did that letter, it was mostly a letter saying you really need to hire Larry back, and you just need to, and that's what you really need to do when it comes to IT. And he'll do you a great turn. I had talked to Larry and said, Larry, anytime you want to come back, I would be glad to have you. And of course, he had his own private grievances, and I'm sure that they included me as well. How dare you think that I would work for you? You should be working for me. And it's like, yeah, I'm not gonna argue about that. He says, this is definitely your baby. He knows what's going on. And he confided in me that he wouldn't be back unless Greg Bush was gone. And that was my last thing. When I did resign, I sent Larry a text, just said, I've resigned. Greg Bush is out of the picture. I'm sure they'll be calling you to at least get consulting from you. And that was the next when I went back on Wednesday to turn in my keys and various other things. That was what I had already heard had happened since I resigned. Was they said, if you guys need anything, just let me know. It was from Alan Moss, who had just been named the interim president. Well, temporary, whatever. They couldn't name him the interim because Greg Bush had not resigned yet. He resigned a little bit later. I forget how long. It doesn't matter. And and I said, this is good. So this is what needed to happen. I can find work somewhere else, and I'll be okay. I says, I understand other people who left other jobs, usually at colleges, don't have that kind of, I don't know what to call it, flexibility to be able to do these things. So, like I said, it's I'm totally surprised it's only been 8 weeks. I've got my next job. I'm back sleeping in a boat during the week. But there's really a plus to it for me. I'm on a 4-10 schedule, which means that I am away from home less than I used to be. The actual job is in Albuquerque, therefore, I can readily more readily attend to the temple, as it is so close to us. It's really close to my work, and that really works out well. Am I making as much money as I did? No, but it was really kind of, I kind of view it as kind of a fantasy in a way, because it didn't last. Like I said, they hired me, and then as soon as it became obvious that the college really didn't have the money to pay for any of this at all, they started doing austerity, which I think was. Well, they said, here's your solvency plan. And it wasn't solvent. It wasn't solvent yet. And it had been brought up by several people. And I felt like, and I said, that's true. What these people are saying are true. At the end of the day, being supportive of them, it was, if you were to make a good analogy of it. It's like people who are sinking off the Titanic. And that's probably a pretty good vision of it. Except that the state has, if you can get the money out of the state, has a way to make sure that even though the Titanic has these huge holes in it and this bailing water like crazy and trying to keep floating with like quarter just in bad shape. Anyway, when people feel like they're going down, it doesn't matter how wonderful, or I don't know if I was being wonderful at all, but if you're being nice and helpful to people, they're still gonna drown you to try to save themselves. Now on the Titanic, at least in the movie version, golly, there was a bunch of self-sacrifice going on there. I guess I wanted to be that kind of a, I wanted to be that person, So I didn't go down with the ship, but I didn't, I didn't take one of the lifeboats either. I just ceased to be there. I wasn't something to be considered. Leadership didn't have to try to save me. The captain didn't have to figure out if I needed to go on this lifeboat or if I needed to stay behind and be one of those stolid men who we need to save the women and children. Didn't I was just out of the picture. And they go, well, you weren't here trying to help us bail. You weren't here trying to help us get these things going. And you go, no, because I don't, says I didn't have to, so I didn't, and people can think that of me, and that's fine. I'm not going to sit here and justify it and say that I'm still a good person. I'm probably a bad person. But the continued existence of Mesa Lands is at least in my estimation, not I don't even think it's necessary. A successor institution would be just as good, a lot more stable. Now, there's some people who say, well, I lost my job over it, and they go, probably because it just, if the next organization that's doing the same thing doesn't need you, then the first organization probably didn't need you either. And, I guess this ends up being a jobs program. It was certainly done that way. On some level, there was many people, including, I think, the legislators, who said that about the economic side of this, and they couldn't see that a consolidation probably would do more to protect those jobs than basically throwing money at a broken financial system. But that's kind of the way things are, and I'm not, and it's a choice. It's a choice. But I had said this is what I think should be done, and I'm going to make my exit because the people are starting to circle around me with knives and say, you aren't part of it. Boy, let me tell you, our chief diversity officer, and I'd say his name because I considered him a friend, and I probably still do, but yeah, he was basically one of the ones that said, hey, if you're not on our program, you shouldn't be here. And that was really one of the big factors that said, you know what? He's right. I shouldn't be here. So, and I'm sure he was wanting that to be some kind of a form of punishment for my disloyalty to the circumstances. And I was like, well, okay. It's got a perfect point. And that's right. I said, I am in favor of doing something completely different. That means I don't need to be here. I don't need to continue to be a distraction to what you guys are trying to do. The cabinet secretary made that very clear as well. And that all happened in the course of a day. In that day, there was the first getting together of the executive group, and Julio saying, says, if you're not on board with us, you shouldn't be here. And it's like, well, you're not gonna, I don't think you guys have, and I think the unstated consensus was you really can't do that. It says, this is I'm the chief information officer. You can't just tell me that I'm not part of the group anymore. But I took care of it for them by resigning. I was no longer part of the group. They could go on without my unwanted input. And it's like, okay. I says, that's fine. I can find someplace else to be. I don't have to be here. And if I'm not gonna, and if I'm not helpful, I'm not, and I wasn't saying I was gonna be helpful. It wasn't that I was going to deny it to them, but it was like, no, this is, you guys don't need to be paying me to be problematic for what you guys want to accomplish. And I'm not going to try to explain it or stuff like that. It's just interesting after 8 weeks now that I'm looking at it. So, It's interesting coming back and saying, "So Nemro, would you have done something differently?" And you go, "Well, I don't see that I would have done anything differently than I did." And I'm still of a mind not to really particularly to to have behaved differently or done differently or changed anything. And people can have their own attitudes about, "Well, he's a traitor. He's a traitor," or something, And it's like, "Well, whatever. Whatever you guys feel." I don't think I'm a complicated person, but I'm sure I complicate other people's lives. I can't think for a minute that I make Andy swap just not sure what exactly he thinks of me. It's always convenient. Usually when somebody makes a huge mess, they tend to just go away completely. You don't even know that they exist anymore. They move off to wherever they need to go, and I haven't. And that's got to be tricky too. And I think to a large extent, I have suggested that I probably need to be released. However, as long as you choose not to, that's totally up to you. And I know it's like, "Well, I don't want to get rid of you just because I don't want you." I make everybody question their motives to a certain extent. I really do, I think. And that's got to be hard. I know people will go, "Well, then stop doing it. Just get into line. Get good." You go, "Oh, that ain't gonna happen." Lisa struggles because she feels like we've been put out to pasture. And it's like, "You know what, Lee? Maybe we have." And you know what? That's okay. That's all right. It says if it's just not interesting, then it's not interesting. And you go, do previous does previous leadership affect future leadership? Yes. If that's true, then yeah. Chances of me being in any kind of leadership, either on the branch or on the stake level, are zero because, they go, nobody wants to deal with Nemro. The powers that be. And you go, "Well, that's not the way the church works, It's inspired, the Lord says." And you go, "Nah, you're cute." And you go, "I'm not saying that the Lord can't have his influence on things. But that's only when people tolerate it." And I'm not gonna get on to anybody for that sense of tolerance. I think about some of the, I don't know, troublemakers. And I can't but yet think of John the Baptist as being somebody who's just a political nightmare. There's a good reason why John the Baptist wasn't the Messiah. He was just too much trouble. And not the kind of trouble people wanted. They wanted another Judah Maccabee, and John the Baptist wasn't that. And he was a good he was he a great prophet? Christ said he was, so there you go. You have to sit there and look at it. Of course, I'm sure people go, "How was he a greater prophet than like Elijah?" Somebody safely far enough in the past and a faith promoting story maybe that you didn't have to fret it. It's really difficult to have to be a leader in your own time. Everybody looks at the past, once your chapter is ended, they can write a good eulogy of you, and the eulogy is what sticks. Anyway, so I'm a different kind of leader. And it's like, well, he's not the kind of leader that I want. And you go, that's fine. I said, you just, whatever. Go that way. It's really interesting because everybody talks about, well, we all need to be humble and teachable. And I always find it interesting that usually the people who are saying to be humble and teachable are usually saying that they need to be the teachers, and that by its nature, on many levels, that's not very humble. It's almost like such people use these concepts as a tool. You will get your teaching from me, and you will be humble to my will. And it's like, holy free holies. Are you Jesus Christ to be saying that? It's like, well, no, but, somebody's got to do it, I suppose. And they can't be very tolerant of other voices that might be talking in ways that counter what they're saying. And that's tricky. And you're going, well, then, Nimrod, you're an apostate. And you're going, it depends on who you talk to. From a Mesalan's way of doing things, I'm sure that that's exactly what I am, is this horrible apostate. That causes more problems than anything else. And I think it's, I'm sure I put Andy Swapp in a horrible quandary as the branch president. And it really is. It says, you know what? I said, I think it would be incredibly wise for you to release me. Because I will continue to do what I'm doing. I just won't do it in venues where you have to really pay attention to it, which I think is better for everybody involved. He would much rather have different people doing these things. And that's just fine. I find that I get in people's way too much. And my concept of councils is divergent from other people's concepts of it. Oh, I'm going to go ahead and get up so that sound quality might get different. As I get out here, got to get out from under my mosquito netty. Okay. Pardon me. So, anyway. And so it's been interesting to see maybe how I'm developing too. And I'm sure people would go back and say, this is a bad development. You need to fly more in formation. It's like, ah. And you're going, not that I don't expect you to say this. But, guys, I'm not going to fly in formation for you. I know that's what's wanted. What an interesting course. And it's almost like it's got very little to do with the church. I don't know what to think of that on some level, but it's like, you know, John the Baptist, what was his role in the church? And he said, none. None. Even in the Jewish hierarchy, what was his place? And you go, he was problematic. Problematic in the same way I am. You know, I'm this weird Jewish priest, which is an interesting role in that the purpose of that kind of a role is kind of gone. Service in a temple that doesn't exist. And of course, you know, and it is, you know, is the church kind of a committee thing? Yeah. Is it kind of a council thing? Yeah. Which makes it like kind of like Masonians. I thought something needed to be said, needed to be considered more broadly and more publicly. And the council didn't want to do it. Very stridently didn't want to do it. You know, it ends up being, you know, in a church setting. It says, you can do a lot of what you do independently of it. You just don't put the church's name on it. You're not doing it in the name of the church. You're doing it under your own auspice. And I'm in an interesting position because as a Cohen, I'm not beholden particularly to an organization. My role that way is hereditary. I don't get to dictate what the responsibilities are, but to be honest, the responsibility. Oh, it's going to be nice when I can just stand up. But the responsibilities are kind of being, are just kind of not there at the moment. You know? There's no temple in Jerusalem that needs. That needs a priest. The only example I have of a priest acting was John the Baptist, like I said. So it ends up being that. Now I can't, you know. I can't, of my own volition, baptize people. Not given, not provided for, not, you know, there's an organization and structure to it. The only thing I can do is keep myself worthy that when it's needed, I can be called upon to do this. But most likely, unless the actual candidate says, I want Jason Nimmer to baptize me or do something for me. I do a lot of temple service right now. You know, I go to the temple now. Dallas Kernut is gave me some names to work on. So I'm working those names for her. Glad to do it. Glad to do it. Glad for the opportunity. So it makes me into this weird individual. You know, it's, is Nimrod an apostate? And you go, yeah. Trust me, Mesa Land, my leadership found me to be a heretic. And was probably quite happy when I left so blithely. Make sure I get my keys here. Okay. Where's my... Oh, it's out here. Right. So, yeah. So I find myself not thinking a lot about Mason, just occasionally. Let me pause this for a minute. Okay, I'm back in. Actually, I'm in the car. Let me get a drink here. Here I thought it was 5, and it's actually 4. I wanted to show up kind of early to work anyway, so I could get away early. Make sure that I got to the temple at a good time. All right. Anyway, so let's I ate quite a bit yesterday. I decided to go. Oops, sorry. Decided to go and get some chicken. Fried chicken I have very rarely. Lisa's dietary needs isn't compatible with frying anymore. Maybe with air frying. But the air fryer that we had didn't last very long. I think Lisa's kind of... I don't mind getting her another one. It was good stuff. Anyway, so regardless, I'm sure people would love to treat me as an apostate. It's kind of hard when I quote with agreement. Apostles. I'm not agreement with, when I quote apostles and what they say, it's almost like when they say, well, Jason, you just got this whole view of Christ that's just, it's not good, it's not right. And you go, but,
I don't know if this really works good or anything. I think it gets a lot of vibrations. Anyway. Ooh, lots of rabbits today. You're still going to hear it, but it won't be the actual phone itself vibrating particularly. Anyway, you know, I don't think there's a term for me except wild man. Like I said, I find so much of a kinship with John the Baptist on some level. I'm sure it causes some anguish. Because, honestly, you know, it's like, well, we don't like what you're saying. And you're going, what? Repent? Coming to Christ? More stridently? Be baptized? You know, look to your covenants with Christ. I'm not here to make you feel good particularly. Where it seems like a lot of people, that's the most important thing is, oh no, we want you to feel good. We want you to go and do things. You know? And it's like, well, come on. And I'm not saying, like I said, I'll always say this, I'm not the paragon of anything. You know, I said, you're a hypocrite. And you go, I'm a hypocrite because you don't want me saying what I'm saying, even though I'm having problems doing it. You don't want to hear that you need to do it either. Come on. That is, it's just like everybody in the modern parlance. Anytime somebody says something you disagree with, you call them a bigot or a homophobe, you know, and you twist everything that way. It's like, yeah, you can do the same thing with being a hypocrite, too. Well, you're not doing what you preach. And you go, yeah, because I try to preach what Christ preaches. I said, I'm pretty weird about just saying what I think Christ is saying when he says it in the scriptures. Now I'm to the point to where I'm in Mormon now. And Mormon's just getting to the point to where I think he's trying to feel better about the fact that he totally turned himself from leadership because of wickedness and abominations among the people of Nephi, and that he won't lead them anymore. And he talks about how much time he spent leading their armies and cajoling them to try to get them to do better, and how they wouldn't do it. And, you know, I guess he's trying to make himself feel good. That's fine. You know, I don't care. You know, I don't do things to make me look bad. And I go, hey, my name's Jason Devereaux, and that's my, I swear that's my modus operandi sometimes. Is that I am here to totally make myself look bad. I don't expect other people, you know, I have always told people, I said, don't, you know, follow Christ, please do not follow me. I'm schizophrenic. I'm sick in the head, you know, and I'm sure they thought that about John the Baptist. That's why they described him as a wild man. Because they just said, I would never do that. I would never go out into the wilderness and go and teach you know, whoever came out to the wilderness to go see the wild man, just as a curiosity maybe, or whatever, and you know, and I don't have any take on any of that, except to say this is what it says. Are you doing it? And you go, no, I'm actually a bad example. And you go, well, then you should keep your mouth shut. And you go, well, then no one will ever speak of Christ ever again. Because until we can be exactly like him, we shouldn't say a word about him or whatever. You know, we should give him a Book of Mormon or a Bible and say, here, read this. Don't talk to each other about it because we are unworthy. And you're going, eh, quit getting like that. It says, we say it. One day we'll do it. You know, it's really off-putting to people when they say, well, you're being so... One of Lisa's... the sisters that she's supposed to minister to, got in her face. Well, not that she gets in her face, but just nasty about, you know, I don't want anything to do with you. I don't like you, and I don't like what you say. And it's like, and you go, you're too preachy. And you're going, what? What's the problem with that? And we were bringing her a ham. And I said, so you don't want a ham? No, I don't want anything to do with you people. And it's like, so we're giving you something that you might like, but you don't want to have anything to do with it. Said, how noble of you. You know, I didn't get it. Because frankly, it didn't make any sense to me. Oh, I can put this back up in the little holder here. Anything like that. I'll have to hold it. Okay. All right, we're on hardtop again. Yay! Gotta keep an eye on my tires all the time. Make sure I change out my tires. After replacing some wheel bearings. Gonna keep this little car running. Doing its job for me. Anyway, so... yeah, you know, and you go, well, so I can see people's confusion and angst about me, and that they say one thing, but I'm sure they think quite another, and I don't hold any grudges against anybody. I'd be confused too. When I try to put myself in other people's shoes, it's like, well, what do you do with Nemro? And you go, you don't have to do anything with Nemro. Nemro will do what Nemro does. Is what you can do is decide in what forums you will tolerate him. So, yeah. And you go, that's okay. He says, you know, I do my own road. I know it's confusing because they go, well, we need to redeem Brother Nemro. He needs to behave differently. And you go, and what? I need to be stupid? I need to... I need to be far more worried about my career? I need to... What? What exactly? I guess I understand more people who are very difficult to live with. I don't want to be difficult to live with. Anyway. but I guess I am. I don't know who or if John the Baptist was married, but it must have been quite a trial to be John the Baptist's wife, if there was such a person. I don't ask my wife to be with me that way. And that's problematic too, you know. I'm going to call it the Mormon culture. The Mormon culture tells you what you're supposed to do. And my wife is trying to be a dutiful wife. She struggles. She struggles with a lot of things that way, with Mormon culture. And I'm the first one to just say, just forget it. You know, do what you think is right. But see, Lisa's a good person, and she's got to do what she's, and she tries to be a good person in the eyes of others. She tries to do a good job. And she gets frustrated because the separation between what is stated and what is real, really she struggles with. I guess other people have this wonderful capability to almost lie to themselves and say they're doing fantastic things when they're really kind of being jerky. And it's like, no, I guess I don't have that filter. I said, I know I'm being jerky. I'm trying to get us somewhere. And, and they go, well, you're not supposed to be the one driving. And they go, oh, whatever. It says, if you don't like what I'm doing, release me. You know, if you don't like this and you don't like that, it says now. If you try to take my temple recommend away because I'm not being the good and proper little foot soldier that you really desire, that's not one of the criteria of being, you know, of being in the church. And being a decent member of the church. Kind of. You know, because you know, it says, you calling me to a calling is not a straitjacket. You get this idea that constitutes a straitjacket, and that having me in this calling is a way to moderate me. And you go, no, absolutely not. And you go, well, then we'll never call you. You'll never be, if you're trying to appeal to my pride, which most people do, you know, it says, well, don't you want to be somebody of significance in this company? Don't you want to have positions of honor in this church? Then you will behave yourself in this fashion. Then you will do things this way. You will pay your dues, I would suppose, is the proper way to say it. And you go, nope. I said, now, you know, I said, and I guess in that way, I guess maybe I'm not very humble and not very teachable, at least not on those levels. It's like, you know what? I said, teachable by the Spirit. I said, and can I be honest? I said, I think most people are letting their personal feelings get in the way of spiritual promptings. And when you do that, well, then I think it's totally off the table. That's what we need to be teachable to the gospel and to spiritual promptings. Not the other thing. It's like, oh no, I am going to teach you about how to be a good manager. And you're going, well, I'm not interested in being a good manager. Well, you took the manager job. I said, I went for the manager job. You said you wanted me to do it. Now you want me to be this kind of a person. They go, what gave you the impression I was that kind of a person? I said, I was a leader. A leader is not a manager. A leader leads. And you're going, well, there's a certain place we want you to go. There's a certain thing we want you to do. And you go, no contraire, mon frère. That is being your employee. It says, and I am, you know. And that's why when all of a sudden it's like, well, I can't very well be the employee here, then I leave and go do something else. So, yeah, to circle back now that I'm in the car and I'm on my way to I don't need the car to go fast at all. I'm going to slow down, save some gas. I'm getting 40.7 miles to the gallon here. Beautiful. The slower I go. You know, in this car, it's interesting. It seems the slower I go, the worse the gas mileage gets. It seems like the actual average, as I drive faster, gets better. Which means I don't know if I really trust the indicator particularly. Anyway. They say that in the highest councils of the church, the first presidency, in the Quorum of the Twelve, they must have unanimity. I find this interesting. Because the question often is, well, what constitutes a good kind of unanimity? Is it letting the majority have what it wants? Is it saying, okay, I'm going to stay quiet, and even though I don't agree, or I don't think that this is the right course, or I don't, just whatever. I don't think I'm contrary by nature. I think what I am by nature is, I don't care. You know, in most matters, I don't have all the facts, surely, and therefore, I just say, well, I said, you know, now it's like, well, are you going to go along with the crowd? Are you going to say, this is the wonderful thing to do? And it's like, well, no, I'm not going to say that because I don't know that. I'll probably not talk about it particularly at all. And I think that's how it might work in the upper councils of the church, is that you talk about what you know. You talk about what you've experienced, and you talk about what the Spirit has revealed to you. And that's great. Absolutely wonderful. I don't do the unanimity of we don't need any dissenters. That was pretty much what I was told on February 13th. It says, if you're not with us, you don't need to be here. And it's like, oh. Temple this afternoon, this evening. I'm going to meet up with my wonderful wife. My son, who I hope will talk to them, whoever in the mission presidency happens to be there on Tuesday night. Look at getting a schedule pulled together. Whether it allows us to do the temple together, or be at least be able to run into each other, which would be great. But if it's not, it's like, well, there's that. That's fine. Well, anyway, so trying to sum up. Well, I sum up, I try to sum up occasionally. Right, I don't. The more I circle around the last 8 weeks, the more okay I am with what I did, with what happened, and with what's happened now. I hope things are okay with people in Mesolands. Like I said, I don't think I hold any animosity towards anybody. I think everybody was speaking their hearts, which is good. And I wasn't gonna, I think back to that, the play 1776, the movie that was made from it too, about John Dickinson. And John Dickinson was an honorable man. You can say that he was a traitor, or that he was too much of a loyalist to the king, that he was far too conservative. And I'm not a conservative. I know that is a struggle for many people in the church. I'm sure in Mesolands they go, he's not the right kind of, he isn't the right kind of progressive for us. And you go, I'm not the right kind of anything for anybody. I am not a convenient person. I don't think I am a very good friend to anyone. I guess it depends on what people really, really want. out of things. I don't know. So, anyway. In relation to all that, all that's been spoken, all I can say is, I am who I am. And I am finding myself over time and upon reflection more comfortable with who I am. And I guess that's a good place to leave it. So I will save this little guy back.